Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Friday the 27th of April of the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll learn about tonight's UAS Sun and Spirit presentation by Tom Cosgrove. We'll have to talk to Keegan Messing. His championship skating skills will be highlighted in Saturday's Juneau Skating Club's spring recital. Rand Bar Yushapad will be giving us a preview of his weekend presentations on his perspectives on Israel and the Mideast complex. Nancy Barnes will focus on Saturday's Native Artist Market at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. I'll talk with Sarah Isto, author of the new book, Fur Farms of Alaska. With the forecast for tonight, looks like rain showers are likely with low temperatures around 37 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, cloudy skies and a chance of rain with high temperatures around 51 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Senate passes a reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which expands the role of tribal courts. Matt Laszlo reports.
The bill passed the Senate by a wide margin, but many Republicans don't like that the Senate version allows non-natives who commit crimes against natives in Indian country to be prosecuted under tribal courts. They're also upset over provisions to grant more visas to undocumented workers who are abused, and that it extends protections to the gay, lesbian, and transgender community. But Maryland Democratic Senator Barbara Mikulski says GOP complaints ring hollow because updating the legislation is nothing new.
We have continually reauthorized this legislation, looking at new needs and new technology and new creative ways of responding to these needs for prevention, intervention, and even prosecution.
The House has yet to reauthorize the legislation, but this week Republicans in that chamber announced they're moving ahead with their own version, which could strip out the new authority for tribal courts. They say Democrats are playing politics with the bill by adding touchy political issues to it during an election year. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A Massachusetts tribe unveils plans to build a casino in the southeast part of the state, away from its Cape Cod headquarters. WBUR's Kurt Nickish has more.
Massachusetts has legalized casino gambling, and the law gives preference to a tribal casino. That means the Mashpee Wampanoag have the inside track. Tribal Chair Cedric Cromwell presented plans for a development in the city of Taunton, less than an hour's drive from Boston.
This in itself will be, number one, a best-in-class destination resort casino. That will bring people from not only across the Commonwealth, across the country, and across the world to Taunton.
The $500 million development would have 3,000 slot machines, three hotels, one with a water park, restaurants, shops, and a spa. Cromwell says it would give a lift to the financially struggling city.
Jobs. Creating jobs and getting people working.
It's why the tribe has the support of Taunton Mayor Tom Hoy.
Am I saying this is a cure-all, that this is going to cure all our problems? Absolutely not. But I don't want to be a mayor that sits back and does nothing.
Still, a number of challenges remain before the Mashpee can win a casino license. Another tribe, the Wampanoag of Aquinnah, are going for a license too. But Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Chair Cedric Cromwell says gaming compact talks with the state are going well. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Nickish.
28 Indigenous women compete for the Miss Indian World title. Many are already role models and say they'd promote positive changes on a national level if crowned. Edith Starr, San Carlos Apache, says she'd address AIDS.
Not that many Native Americans now, they will come out and say they have AIDS and HIV because they get bullied. And then some, it's scary to like hide it. But as a nation, we should come together as Native Americans, and it's human to feel it. It's not going to mean your life is ending. It doesn't mean anything.
Erlene Patricio Tohono O'odham says she'd promote higher education.
Having a high school diploma is very good, but continuing on into college and getting a degree in whatever it is that you have a passion for, and then coming back to your community, to your home, and giving back to your people is something that I think that should inspire everyone to, you know, go out and pursue.
UPIC Kelsey Wallace says suicide is a major issue.
We've had 6 suicides since December, and, you know, it's my friend's brother, my cousin out in the village, you know, it's these people that I've been growing up with, and, you know, nobody addresses these issues, especially at a younger perspective. I mean, if someone is younger, they don't really take that person seriously. And to be able, you know, to have someone in that age, that same age group, be able to approach those people and say, hey, you know, this isn't the way that we're supposed to be living. You know, life is worth so much.
The winner will be crowned Saturday at the Gathering of Nations powwow in New Mexico. On this day in 2011, Yupik professor, anthropologist, and actor Dr. Oscar Quagley died. He was well known for his writings on indigenous methodology and his appearances in television and film. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Tom Cosgrove. He's the featured storyteller in tonight's University of Alaska Southeast Sound and Motions series. It's the final presentation tonight at 7 o'clock in the Egan Lecture Hall. Tom, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff.
So, first of all, great show in the library a few weeks ago.
I appreciate it. Appreciate you being there. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We had a good crowd and got to tell all about our ventures across the U.S.
Your nearly normal vacation.
Our nearly normal road trip.
What makes for a nearly normal trip to you?
I think the whole concept of nearly normal is that we all are consider ourselves somewhat normal in the scheme of things, but we all have adventures. Every day things happen to us, and to me that's all part of being nearly normal, focusing on those adventures.
What got you into sharing your stories in the first place?
Jeff, I've been a closet writer my entire life, and the thought of not having those stories out there and being shared, it was getting published, as you may well know, is somewhat of a difficult experience. And so moving to actually telling the stories got me out there to share the stories, and I get immediate feedback. I know if they work, I know if they don't, and oftentimes if you write, even if you get published, those stories go out into the universe, and you don't know what happens. So it's a very tangible, real way to share these stories.
How do you sculpt a story from an experience or two?
There's no formula. I wish there was a formula. Lots of times what it is taking the experiences, I will actually start and write it out in prose because that's the world I'm comfortable with. And after I take that story written in prose, I'll literally stand up and start talking to myself and see what works, what doesn't. Because when you start getting into the spoken form of a story, then things are greatly different. The sentence that works so well on paper sounds absolutely silly when you say it out loud. And so working, sculpting it back and forth, seeing what works and what doesn't. And so that it's more of a process of give and take over time, and eventually I can tease out some of the humor and some of the more poignant moments.
I was going to say, humor seems to be a common factor in many of your stories, but I imagine it goes deeper than that.
I think humor is, of course, the common currency in any storytelling. It's something that we can quickly share with people, and people can quickly relate. Poignant moments or moments of sorrow are a little harder for some people to relate to. However, I do, especially this evening, I've got a couple of stories that I consider extremely poignant and powerful.
Do you warn people they might be part of a story, or do you change names to protect the innocent?
I think, fortunately, most of these stories are about me, and unfortunately for my family. I've got my daughter, Natalie, sitting here. She's not going to be on the air today, but she has appeared in more than one story. So I think most folks can feel quite at ease that they're not going to appear in my stories, though I have had more than one person come up to me afterwards. They say, "Is that me? Were you talking about me?
Were you talking about my beer belly?"
I was, as a matter of fact.
Thanks a lot. I'm talking to storyteller Tom Cosgrove. He's going to be making his Sound and Motions show tonight at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall. What's in the show tonight, Tom?
Well, I've got, from my recent show of our road trip, I picked out some of the more popular pieces out of that. And I'm actually going back to my first show, our Nearly Normal Alaskan Tales, and there was a couple of stories that I've done in that show that have constantly been favorites for people. And I'm going to take those two groupings and add a few new ones, and I've got pretty much a new show out of that. So folks that have actually seen me before, I've got new stuff for you, and if you've never seen me, come, some of my greatest hits.
What do you think makes for a good story?
I think easily related things, experiences that are easily related to other people. And I think ultimately a story is good is if people can laugh with you and you can laugh at yourself. So sharing moments that would otherwise be embarrassing or compromising in some place makes you vulnerable, and then people are open and willing to accept.
Seems like their personal stories that they're getting too personal.
I'm crossing that line. I've got a story I'm telling tonight that I have had written many, many years ago and have always lacked the courage to share it. So I'm somewhat coming out of the closet on one of these stories. Because it is. Some of these things are close to the bone.
Tom Cosgrove will be selling free tonight at 7 o'clock at the Egan Lecture Hall. And you should get there early because the show at the library was packed full of people, and they were all happy people, too.
Yeah, it was great. And So I'm also going to give a plug that I'm trying to come up with. I call myself a storyteller, personal experience storyteller, but to me it's beyond that. I want to be a monologuist. Does that work, monologuist? I don't know. What do you think?
Whatever you want to call yourself is okay with us.
No, I was looking for your opinion, Jeff.
I'm a radio announcer. I have no opinion. Tom, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Is there anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
Come out and enjoy. It's a lot of fun, and I've had lots of people that come out reluctantly and have turned into fans. So please, come join me.
I'll tell you, personal experience storyteller is a lot easier to say than monologuist.
Okay, that's easy. I knew you had an opinion.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 27th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of August Wilson, born Pittsburgh, 1945, son of a German baker, an African-American cleaning woman, grew up in the Hill District of Pittsburgh with his mother, five siblings, in two rooms, no hot water. They all shared the yard out back. His mother, Daisy Wilson, taught the boy to read when he was four, and a year later, he got his first library card. He was a bright boy, but he suffered from racism in school, dropped out when he was 15 because a teacher accused him of plagiarizing a paper about Napoleon because she didn't think a black student could have written anything so good. So he taught himself at the library. He read Richard Wright, Langston Hughes, Ralph Ellison, joined the army, started writing poetry. When he was 20, his father died, and he dropped his father's name, Kittle, and took his mother's name, Wilson. And he and a friend started a theater company in the Hill District where he grew up, staged his first play in 1973. When he was 33, August Wilson moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. He took a job at the Science Museum, writing scripts, adapting Native American stories. Sent a play to the Playwright Center in Minneapolis. He won a Jerome Fellowship. His play Jitney was produced, set in the Hill District in the 1970s. And then came Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, set in the 20s. Fences, set in the 60s. Joe Turner's Come and Gone, set in 1911. August Wilson set out to chronicle African-American experience through the 20th century, decade by decade, and his final play in his 10-part Pittsburgh cycle was Radio Golf, which is set in the 90s. It premiered in 2005, and Wilson died of liver cancer 6 months later. August Wilson said, "My greatest influence has been the blues, and that's a literary influence, because I think the blues is the best literature that we as black Americans have. Blues is the bedrock of everything I do. If all this were to disappear off the face of the earth, and some people 2 million years from now would dig out this civilization and come across some blues records, they would be able to piece together who these people were, what they thought about, what their ideas and attitudes toward pleasure and pain were, all of that, all the components of culture." And it's the birthday of the author of the Madeleine books, Ludwig Bummelmans, born in the Tyrol, Austria, 1898, came to New York when he was 16, worked at a series of hotels, started his own restaurant, which became successful. And then a friend of his, who was in publishing, saw Bemelman's drawings on the walls of his apartment, suggested he write a children's book, and that was Madeleine. Ludwig Bemelman's, who said, "It is always wonderful when something altogether wrong ends right without the help of religion or the police. Here's a poem for today by William Stafford, In the White Sky. Many things in the world have already happened. You can go back and tell about them. They are part of what we own as we speed along through the white sky. But many things in the world haven't yet happened. You help them by thinking and writing and acting. Where they begin, you greet them or stop them. You come along and sustain the new things. Once, in the white sky, there was a beginning, and I happened to notice and almost glimpsed what to do. But now I have come far to here, and it is a way back there. Some days I think about it. In the White Sky by William Stafford, from his Stories That Could Be True, published by Harper and Row, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Betsy Alistair, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
I'm 3:17, and you are tuned to KTLO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Keegan Messing, along with Pam Leary, here to talk about the Juneau Skating Club's spring recital going on Saturday at 7 p.m. Keegan and Pam, thank you very much for being in the station with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Keegan, first of all, how old were you when you got serious about skating?
When I seriously got into skating, I was probably around 6 years old. I don't know. I started skating when I was 3 years old. I was watching the Olympics with my mom on my with me on her lap, and saw a Stoico skate and wanted to do it pretty much ever since.
I should mention that you are a championship skater. You've just participated in many competitions statewide and also nationals, taking away some good honors. When did you first lose your fear of falling?
Well, I don't think I've ever really had a fear of falling. Sometimes you take a really nasty fall and you do get scared of it after a while, but best thing for it is just go for it again and hope for the best. Get over it right then and there so it's easier the next day.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the honors you've received as a skater?
What was that?
Do you talk about the honors you've received as a skater?
Honors.
Awards?
Awards.
I just won the Cup of Nice down in France this year. That was pretty cool. I got the 3A award from USFSA.
What's the 3A award?
That was something that the Athlete Alumni Committee put together for us skaters, and it was pretty much a volunteering award on who cared about the committee, and I put together a little note, put it in, and they chose me for it, and I felt pretty cool about that.
How do you put together an Olympic competition-winning routine?
Takes a lot of work. I'm actually, right after the Juneau show, I'm heading down to Utah to get my long program for this next upcoming season. So that's going to be a trip, and I can't wait.
What kind of things are we going to be seeing on Saturday at 7 o'clock at the Turtle Arena?
A lot of fun. It's going to be a great family show.
Are you going to show us any triples?
That's all I can do. I can't do a double anymore. yeah, it's going to be a very, very fun show. I'm going to skate my new short program that I've got for this next upcoming competitive season. It's going to be to Sing Sing Sing, and just a very upbeat, fun music. And the other one is, I can never remember the name, so I'm sorry about that.
Good Feeling.
Okay, that's it.
by Flo Rida.
But that's another fun one, and it's just going to be fun. Throwing the triples, fast spins, and got all the Juneau skaters here to make it a complete show.
And what age do most skaters stop skating competitively?
When their bodies ache too much to go on.
And how old are you?
I'm 20 years old.
How much of a career do you see ahead of you?
Hopefully a good one. I see at least, I'm hoping to see two Olympics, the 14 and the 18.
Do you have any advice to younger and also advice to older skaters?
Keep going. When life gets you down, just bite your teeth and keep going.
Pam Larry is also in the studio with us to talk about the Juno Skating Club. Pam, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Thanks.
So the Juno Skating Club, if you want to educate us about the club, please.
Sure. It is a club that was formed in 2003. It's a learn-to-skate program, so we teach basic skills from age 4 and up, and we have plenty of adults that are learning to skate in addition to tots and everybody, boys and girls, men and women of all ages. We also have a figure skating program and a hockey skills program that kind of fall on the tail once you complete the basic skills program. You can go into either figure skating or hockey.
And this Saturday at 7 o'clock is your spring recital. How many skaters and what are their ages are taking part?
Well, believe it or not, this year we have 60 skaters that are going to be performing for everybody on the ice. Oh. And the theme is the history of rock and roll on ice. So we're going to do it by decades, starting with the 1950s. Actually, with Keegan's skating to Sing, 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 we're going to do a little history of the background, where rock and roll comes from, and some of the jazz. And that's going to go into then the 1950s up through today and the different artists musically across each decade will be skated to by our skaters.
What's easier to teach, people who are new to skating completely or people who need remedial skating and have learned a bunch of bad habits?
It's actually, teaching anybody at any level is really, really fun. And I really like seeing progress in my students. So if they know a little bit, maybe I can help them get to the next level. If they know nothing, it's actually great to see how much progress people can make, especially little kids, because they're fearless on the ice when they get there usually. And they can not even have been on the ice before, and before you know it, they're standing up and marching across, and that's fun to see, too.
What's your favorite part about teaching skating?
I think accomplishment, seeing people know that they can do something that they never thought that they could do.
60 skaters doing something that they couldn't think they could do all at once.
It's great, great fun. I mean, we have a bunch of soloists this year that are, a lot of them have just graduated from the basic skills program into figure skating. And so this is the first time that they're doing, you know, solos in the big spring recital. And so it's very exciting for them.
And what happens to those people who said, oh, they're talking about skating, oh, I blew it again, I can't learn how to skate this year. When are you opening up your skating?
Yes, unfortunately, the rink closes on Sunday. I think the last open skate is, I think it's 6 o'clock, and then they take out the ice, and it'll be back in August. We have 4 sessions a year of 6 weeks long, 2 before the holidays, 2 after every year. And so we usually start up in September, and you can go to our website to get more information about when basic skills classes will start in September. And that website is www.junoskatingclub.org.
Keegan, what do you do to warm up for a routine?
Normally back home when I'm warming up just for a regular practice day, I run normally about a half mile to a full mile every day before I get on the ice. I run a couple stairs, loosen up the knees and ankles, jumps, rotation jumps, jump rope. I stretch a little bit and get on the ice and warm up your footworks and just ease your body into it every day. You wake up in the morning, you're hurting, and you always gotta ease yourself back into it every morning.
I'm Keegan Messing, award-winning championship skater, and also Pam Leary, probably award-winning teacher. Thanks for talking about the Juno Skating Club and their reception recital going on 7 o'clock this Saturday at the Treadwell Ice Arena. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I do want to say that most of our tickets are sold out, but I understand that there are going to be about 25 at the door that will be available first come, first serve, no promises, at about 6 p.m. tomorrow. And the show starts at 7 p.m. It's going to be a great time, lots of rock and roll music. You get to see Keegan do his jumps and spins, and it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
All right, thanks so much for coming by.
Well, thank you very much.
At 9 years old and sweet as she can be,
time is 3:27, and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Stuart Gerger and also Ron Bar Yoshevat here to talk about Ron's series of discussions and lectures coming up this weekend. Thank you for coming down to the station, everybody.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
So, Ron, you are with a group called Stand With Us Northwest.
That is correct. I came here to volunteer to try to educate people about Israel and engage with the dialogue with as many people as possible.
Now imagine meeting an alien who arrives on Earth for the first time and says, what's happening here? What's happening in the Middle East as far as Israeli and Middle East relations are concerned?
Well, the first thing I'll have to tell to this alien is, I cannot give you this only in a nutshell. It's a very complicated issue that has been going on for many years. So it'll be my first thing to say. I think that it's a great opportunity for me to meet people because it'll give them a chance to meet an Israeli, not to hear something from the media or read about it, just actually meet a person and ask. And then to each and every other topic that they want to talk about, this conflict, that issue, I'll need about an hour to give the the briefing summary information, but yeah.
A little bit of your background, you went to a law school?
Yes, I am a lawyer. I did my legal residency. In Israel, we have legal residencies at the Israeli parliament, what we call the Knesset. And I gave legal advice to members of the parliament, the Israeli parliament.
What inspired you to take this course of action, visiting people all across the United States and talking about life in Israel?
Well, I'm very passionate about Israel, just like most Israelis are very passionate about Israel. And I've noticed that a lot of people who don't know much about Israel have a tendency to not like it. And I thought that the best way for me to have change that mindset is to meet people and say, hey, this is, you know, what Israel is about. Israel has a lot to offer to the world. I would like to educate people about Israel. And that's basically why I'm spending my time here.
What's the biggest misconception people have about Israel?
Well, I think that, first of all, the biggest problem is that people think it's very simple and it's a very complex issue, Israel. That's the first thing. The biggest misconception is I think they don't understand how much people in Israel want to live in peace and how much people in Israel are really open for a dialogue.
The other thing I would point out, that one of the things that people don't understand about Israel and the Middle East is the physical size. I tell folks that if I had a neighbor who lived on Fritz Cove Road and I'm downtown and we got into a big argument and they decided to start shelling my house with mortar, that's about what scale is in Israel. You know, from some of the places on the West Bank to Jerusalem or even from Lebanon into northern Israel. You know, it's Fritz Cove to downtown. And so that the scale of things and how close people are and how easy it is for threats to turn into real violence is something that I think that people, especially in a place like Alaska, don't understand or don't know. And so that's just an important part of the picture, too.
Can you tell us about the organization Stand With Us Northwest?
Yes. Stand With Us is an organization that deals with Israel education and advocacy. And, basically, I'll be repeating myself a little bit. But the main goal is to educate people about Israel. Because maybe it's the geographical distance, but people don't really understand not the geography, not the political issues, not the security issues. So we're trying to provide people with information, basic education, and also, again, to engage with the dialogue, to speak with people.
And how long have you been doing this?
About 3 months, and I'll be in the United States until June.
What's people's first question that pops out of their mouth after you finish talking?
Oh, well, it really depends on the audience. If it's a more supportive audience, it can be, it'll be not a question, it'll be a statement. Thank you for doing this. If it's a more hostile audience, it'll be like, why are you so aggressive? But the vast majority of people are just uninformed, so they can ask me questions like, can people vote in Israel? They don't know that Israel is a vibrant democracy. They can ask me, again, size-wise, how big is Israel? Like, well, it can fit in Washington State several times. In Alaska, I don't even know how many times it can fit. So it depends on the audience.
You're leading a bunch of workshops and discussions this weekend, and I'm going to ask if you could list the discussion groups that you're hosting, and maybe you'll talk a little bit about each one.
Okay. Well, there are a series of presentations, but the emphasis really is on presentations that then turn into conversations. Tonight at Sukkot Shalom at 7 o'clock, Ron's theme is a question about how the Jewish state, how Jewish should the Jewish state be? So it involves some social and religious issues. That's open to the public at 7 p.m. tonight at Sukkot Shalom. Tomorrow night also at Sukkot Shalom in the evening is a Growing Up in Israel. Ron will talk about his childhood, what it's like to be a kid in Israel. How is it the same? How is it different than other places?
I'm going to take just a break for a minute.
Sure.
Can you describe what growing up was in Israel is like?
Well, I don't think people know how similar life in Israel and America is. I grew up on Friends and Seinfeld, you know, that's why I speak English. So if I have any grammar mistakes, I'm just playing television. But there was one thing that made my life very different than the life of the average American, and that was the time that we refer to as the Second Intifada, which is a period of time between the years 2000 and 2005 when Israel suffered from massive terror attacks. Buses would explode, schools, shopping malls, and that really changed my childhood because, you know, you wouldn't go on a bus or you wouldn't go into a pizza shop or a coffee shop because a group of terrorists would try to hurt you. So that was very, very different for me than, I guess, an average life of an American.
What made you decide to go to law school?
Well, I always had an interest in figuring out what is it we consider right and what is it that we are considered to be wrong. And I think legal education gives you a good set of tools to deal with these topics.
Stuart, I'm sorry for interrupting, but anytime you want to break in and talk a little louder.
That's all right. On Sunday, there's a couple of events. There's something in the late afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Juneau Cooperative Church Council. And I wanted to take a moment and thank all of the folks who have welcomed Ron and invited him to participate in events like the Cooperative Church Council. At Resurrection Lutheran Church at 4 o'clock, Ron's presentation and discussion will be what could peace look like from an Israeli perspective. Later on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the JAC, the World Affairs Council is hosting Ron again, and that is Understanding the Israeli-Arab Conflict, an overview, and again, a conversation. On Monday at noon at the State Office Building, Ron will be in the atrium, and we'll just have something open to drop in for a brown bag lunch and learn. And then Monday night at I always get this wrong. I keep saying Good Shepherd in the Valley, but it's Shepherd of the Valley. There's a teen program, an interchurch teen program that we're very excited about. And again, the Cooperative Church Council has been wonderful in organizing this and co-sponsoring it with us. And it's focused, the main invitees are any teenagers, age 5th to 12th grade, welcome to join. And it's really a discussion about becoming human, getting beyond stereotypes. The Middle East is a place that is a perfect example of, you know, where ignorance has bred hatred, and so such an important thing is for people to sit down, meet each other, talk to each other, and so this interchurch teen program is an opportunity for Ron and some other folks to moderate an event on talking about that, getting past stereotypes. And then on Tuesday, Ron will, his last day in Juneau, has been invited by the school district to speak with and work with high schoolers at the three high schools. And then he's back to Seattle.
Can you go over the list on Sunday? There's one of the workshops I wanted you to elaborate on just a little bit about what does peace mean to an Israeli?
Ron, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, when I grew up before the Second Intifada, I grew up with Palestinians. They would visit me at my school. I would visit them at their school, villages, and buy at their markets. I think that the first thing you need to do is to meet the other side. Sit down and talk with them, because then you see that we're all pretty much the same. And I don't have any problems with the Palestinian people. The only problem I have is with their government, which is Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. How would peace look like? Well, if people would be more educated and will be able to meet the other side and just see them face to face, that'll be the first step. Unfortunately, right now we have less interaction with the Palestinians in Israel because of their government, but I really hope that in the future that will change. And once that will change, I'm a strong believer that most people in the world just want to live in peace, maybe get married, maybe find a steady job. And I believe that that's true for both sides. And I hope that, you know, once they'll get, you know, we have an Arab Spring now, maybe this will also come to the Palestinians. And they will get rid of their really corrupt, horrible government. And then we will be able to engage in a really good, sincere, honest dialogue with them. So that will be the first step towards a meaningful peace.
How do you deal with people who are aggressively disagree with you?
Well, you know, one of the great things about living in a democracy is that you can disagree. It's fine to disagree. You know, it's also fine to criticize Israel. In fact, I would argue that every single Israeli criticizes Israel. It's okay, we're a democracy. But my question is the other person willing to listen to me, to talk with me? Now, if they're not willing to talk or to listen to me or to shake my hand, then they can have their opinion, but, you know, they're not really open for a dialogue, and I guess that there's nothing I can do to change your mind. But if they're willing to come, sit with me, meet me, talk to me, tell me their accusations, listen to me, give them my answers, I have a lot of experience. I served in the Israeli army, in combat, in special forces. I know exactly what was going on. I served as a legal advisor for the Israeli parliament. I have a lot of understanding of the situation. Today, unfortunately, we live in a world of sound bites. You read something, you just read the headline, and you have your opinion based on that. And I think that's a shame. I think that that's the opposite of finding a solution or trying to understand really what is going on.
Stuart, you listed off those discussion groups so quickly. I'm going to have you do it again so people who didn't have a pencil or need to get that information again, they can.
Okay. Tonight, Friday, and tomorrow, Saturday, there are evening events at Congregation Sukkot Shalom over on Douglas at 211 Cordova Street. Tonight is about how Jewish should the Jewish state be. That starts at 7 p.m. Tomorrow night is Growing Up in Israel. That's also at 7 p.m. Sunday, during the day, there are two events at 4 p.m. At Resurrection Lutheran Church, called What Would Peace Look Like? An Israeli Perspective. And at 7 o'clock Sunday evening, the World Affairs Council is hosting an event at the JAC, Understanding the Israeli-Arab Conflict as a Conversational. Monday at noon at the State Office Building, a drop-in, very casual brown bag lunch and learn. And then later Monday in the evening at Shepherd of the Valley Church, out in the Valley, a teen event hosted by the Juno Cooperative, confused by my notes here, Cooperative Church Council, Getting Past Stereotypes. That's in 6:30 on Monday evening, and teens, anyone from 5th to 12th grade is welcome.
Is this information available online?
Yes. Our website, if you've got a pencil, you'll need it, www.sukkotshalomalaska, all one word, that's SUKKATSHALOM Alaska, Sukkot Shalom Alaska, and then it's .net, not com, .net, sukkotshalomalaska.net. Or if you really have a question, just call me on my cell. It's 723-9973.
All right, Stuart, and also Ron Bar Yoshefat, thank you for coming by today and talking about the number of events going on this weekend. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I'm just very happy to be in Alaska. It's my first time. It's very pretty, and it's very different than what I have imagined. I think some people might have a different imagination of Israel, so just like I saw it's different, maybe people, by meeting me, have a different perspective of Israel.
All right, Ron and Stuart, thank you for coming by.
Thanks, Jeff. Nice to see you.
Coming up, not this weekend, but next weekend, is going to be the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. One of the performers is LaVey Smith, and there's a CD from a Red Hot Skillet Licker CD.
Everybody jump, 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 everybody where, well.
music of LaVey Smith and the Red Hot Skillet Liquors. They'll be performing at the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. If you need more information about that, check out their website at www.jazzandclassics.org. In the studio with us now to talk about a Native artist market happening at the Jack this weekend is Nancy Barnes. Nancy, thank you for coming down the station today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. We're calling this the Drummers and Dancers Gathering, and we've got about 16 or 17 tables, artist vendors, that are going to be selling arts and crafts. And that's going to be from 1 to 5:30, and it should be fun. It's a community event, and we're hoping folks will come down and watch some Native dancing. We've got several groups dancing.
This is all to get ready for a celebration coming up right around the corner.
Yeah, we're calling it a pre-celebration event. I had actually organized this in December just because for Cabin Fever, we got a few people together, and we ended up having a couple hundred people that showed up at the Jack. And this time we're doing it a little bit longer. I got a sponsor to help me with the rental of the Juno Arts and Cultural Center. Sea Alaska Heritage is going to help me with that.
Could you elaborate on some of the items that are going to be available for sale?
Oh, anything from, you know, beadwork to, you know, knitted things, just all kinds of Native arts. We're also going to have a table for Relay for Life, helping cancer patients and their families with a lot of baked goods there. We've got people that are going to be selling fried bread and, you know, other good food.
If people need more information about it, is there a number they can call?
Yes, they can call my home number, which is 364-2327. And it's Nancy Barnes. It's going to be from 1 p.m. until 5:30 p.m. tomorrow.
And it's absolutely free to get in?
Yep, it's free. Just like I said, we want to encourage you. Don't have to be in a dance group to dance. We want you to get up and dance, and especially the children.
All right, Nancy Barnes, thank you for coming by.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, hi again, Mr. Chicken. I heard you were wondering about Juno Chicken Summit 2012, Saturday, May 5th, Clucko de Mayo. It will be a great day for chicken enthusiasts with lectures and workshops followed by Juno's first tour de coop, where we will see firsthand how people successfully raise chickens in Juno. It's going to be a bunch of fun and a great way to meet other folks who love raising chickens. Tell your flock to call the UAF Cooperative Extension Service at 796-6221.
I will tell you a story, short only. The Filipino Community Incorporated and Generator Theater Company proudly present Flipsoids by Ralph Pena, April 12th through the 29th at McPheeters Hall, a play that the New York Times called stirring. Flipsoids is the funny and touching story of three Filipino immigrants. Tickets for Flipsoids are available at jahc.org, The Jack, and Hearthside Books. For more information, visit generatortheater.org.
Time is 3:48, and you're tuned to KTUO News in Juno here on a Juno afternoon. Next guest is author Sarah Isto. She's just written a great book called The Fur Farms of Alaska, Two Centuries of History and a Forgotten Stampede, published by University of Alaska Press. She's having a book presentation and a book signing this Sunday from 1 to 3 at Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall. Sarah, thank you for being around the station today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what gave you the inspiration for doing a book on fur farms?
Well, I received some essays written by an uncle of mine in a senior citizen writing class, and found to my surprise that he had been the territorial veterinarian in the 1930s, the only veterinarian in the territory of Alaska, and his job was taking care of the fur farms. He worked under the governor, and he had some marvelous stories in there, so I got interested and discovered that there was no book about this, and discovered that it started with Russian Times and ended in 1993, and that in the year he was hired, there were more than 600 fur farms in Alaska, and the population was 60,000. So it was a big deal, especially during the stampede in the 20s, where many people rushed to start fur farms of all kinds. It wasn't just foxes and mink. It was marten and beaver and muskrat and raccoons and skunks and chinchillas and rabbits. So the whole thing just fascinated me, and so I spent about 4 years traveling around to the Smithsonian and San Francisco and Seattle and all the libraries in the state and managed to put together what I think is a pretty interesting story.
It's a great book. It tells a little bit about Alaskan history and the pioneer generation.
Mm-hmm. It's a piece of history we've kind of forgotten because it was a transient, you know, it was a temporary industry. But at certain times in its history, it was a big deal, the third largest in the territory.
So it all started in 1749.
Right, and that was the Russians. That was just 7 years after Bering's expedition got back to Siberia. The first Siberian foxes were transplanted to Attu Island and the Aleutians. So they were very quick to get started on trying to raise blue foxes in Alaska.
Can you describe the changes in fox farming?
Pardon me?
Can you explain the changes in
island? Yeah, at first it was under the Russians and the early Americans, it was island farming, where foxes were turned loose on an island and offered feed, especially in the winter times of the year. And then when the fur was good in the middle of the winter, they would come in and trap animals. But then it evolved into things that we recognize more like farming, breeding certain animals, providing vitamins and so on, and then moving from the island where the sea was the fence to the mainland where regular fences were used, and a lot more species were then raised. By the time Alaska was a state, the fur farming was declining, but what fur farming there was pretty sophisticated in their breeding and so on.
What do you think led to the eventual decline of fur farming?
Well, it's the market. Before World War II, there was a huge utilitarian market because there was no substitute for furs for warmth and lightness. But when synthetics came along, that market disappeared. The luxury market still remained, but there were many more middle-class people who were not interested in a fur coat, especially if they lived in California. They wanted another automobile or a washing machine or something like that. So the market shrunk. And then, you know, Alaska is a place where it's very expensive to get feed and transportation and all of those things that we know from other industries. And so there is fur farming today, but it's in some of the northern states, in Scandinavia, in China, and there are no fur farms that I know of right now in Alaska.
Do you have any inkling that it would take you 4+ years to do all the research and write the book?
Did I know it was going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
No, of course I didn't know it was going to do that, but I was so interested that I sort of also didn't care. The process was really fascinating. I discovered something new at every turn. I mean, who would have thought somebody would have raised skunks on an island running free with their scent glands still intact? But somebody down by Prince of Wales did.
The book is divided chronologically into 8 sections. Could you elaborate on those 8 sections?
Yeah. The first chapter is the Russian experience. Then there's the early pioneers who followed them, who didn't really know what the Russians had done and sort of reinvented the wheel. And then there's the period that includes World War I. And following that, in the 20s, there are a couple of chapters because there was a huge rush during that period, a stampede, which was sort of started by someone who ended up down here in Southeast, Joe Ibach. He ended up on Limmershire Island. And then in the 30s, the Depression made a big difference. World War II also affected it and ended all fur farming in the Aleutians. And then in the post-war period and statehood, a number of things happened as the industry declined. But the conservationists are involved, the Tlingits are involved, the Aleuts are involved. I mean, there are all of these people who had an influence on this, and it's really quite interesting.
I'm talking to Sarah Isto, who just came out with a book called For Farmers of Alaska, Two Centuries of History and a Forgotten Stampede. Like I said, this is the only book on this subject. How difficult was it to do the research?
Well, it was fairly challenging. As I said, I had to travel, and I had to read a lot because no one had gathered it. So there was a little bit in this file, a little bit in this file. Some of it was government, some of it was private. I have a lot of photographs that were private. And on Sunday, I'm going to try to show a lot of photographs from the Juneau area, as many as I can.
That's 1 to 3 Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall. Why would you say Alaska is well-suited for fur farming?
Well, it had the correct climate for rich furs. It had a lot of independent people who were willing to live on an island and not live in the city for a year or so and just come back into town from time to time. And, you know, a lot of people who are adventurous and entrepreneurs and wanted to try to tame foxes, that was very appealing. There were a lot of people who had foxes that were in and out of their house. Their breeding foxes had names, they could do tricks, you know. And so there was that attraction to animals, which I think we see a lot in Alaska.
So you mentioned in the book that there were two types of ways to deal with the furs. One was to sell them as breeding foxes or breeding fur-bearing animals, and also just to sell the furs themselves.
Yeah. The best thing to do was to sell the animals, the live animals, as breeders. That was much more lucrative. And in 1930, there were at least 3,000 animals shipped out of the territory and probably others sold within the territory as breeders. And those animals, you know, stayed on a farm for many years. And they were quite valuable if they were already proven to have large litters and take care of them and so on. So a pair of foxes would sell for $500 or $600 in the 20s, which was a lot of money.
You said that foxes weren't the only type of animals, and you mentioned a number of others, but what percentage of the animals were foxes indeed?
In the early years, the vast majority were foxes, either silver foxes, which are part of the red fox family, or blue foxes, which are part of the Arctic fox family. We usually think of the little white ones. And then later, mink was very important because mink became more popular than fox starting in about the 30s.
Sarah Isto will be sending copies of her book, For Farmers of Alaska, Two Centuries of History at a Forgotten Stampede, published by the University of Alaska Press. There will be the book signing and presentation Sunday from 1 to 3 at Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall. Sarah, thank you for putting together a great book about a virtually unknown part of Alaska's history. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I can't think of anything except to say that on Sunday I'm going to have a big map up of the area around Juneau with 50 fur farmers' names on it because that I'd gotten off lists, and people will recognize a few names on them, I think.
Sarah, thank you for coming by.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. The Valley and Ock Bay area tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Davis listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sirs Hunet 91.9. Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. Coming up next Monday on a June afternoon, we'll learn about next Saturday's first annual Chicken Summit with guest plucker Darren Snyder, and Ted Merrill will be here with the details about following Saturday's Blessing of the Fleet. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music and More, next Monday at 3 on a June afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, rain likely, low temperatures around 37 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for Saturday night, rain with low temperatures 37 to 43 degrees. Forecast for Sunday, more rain with high temperatures around 52 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to June afternoon today, and have a great weekend.